down to the left side. We will survive in the stock of wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, predatory, and survivalist. Spitting heaven fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening, interesting articles that you can read or download at later times and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things being put in the marketplace all the time. African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by both professors on the continent and in the diaspora. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, interesting conversations that we're set to have, and we'll be talking about the book From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. And our special guest joining us this evening to facilitate that conversation is Professor of Public Policy and African and African American Studies, Economics, and the Director of the Samuel Du Bois Center for Social Equity at Duke University, Dr. William A. Darity Jr. Sandy Darity will be with us, along with writer, folklorist, and founder of director of the Arts Consulting Practice Artifactual, A. Christian Mullen, will be joining us also in the conversation centering around the book From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. And we'll be right back to get the program started. I know some technical difficulties on TuneIn, so listeners there, just hold on and we'll get that straight. Hopefully we'll get it straight over the break. But hold on till after the break and we'll get the program started. Sunday evening, 7:10 here in the city of Philadelphia, and we'll be right back.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests,
brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time For an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And again, it's 7:15 here in the city of Philadelphia. Before we get started with our program, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing great, really. And I have to, you know, Elliot, I try to be a truthsayer. And though, you know, being involved in, you know, the whole thing of reparations for a while, I'm kind of really excited to get engaged, to really be in this moment where, it seems to be in the public forefront right now, politically.
Go ahead.
And we, you know, so, and being engaged with Dr. Darity and Ms. Mullen and around the new book and really helping us be prepared for, you know, I put reparations in two sides, right? The external repair, what we need to get externally for our repair, and what we need to do internally for our repair. And this here in their book, you know, there, it helps us continue to really flush out and, you know, get prepared to wage what is due to us. So I'm really, I said all that to just say I'm excited and looking forward to the interview.
You know, we had Dr. Darity on before. I think he's been on a couple of times, if I'm not mistaken. And he's always been out in the forefront putting together blueprints about how we can achieve reparations as a people, how our people can be repaired from the historical damage of our experience here in this country. The book is kind of a blueprint, and it shows how, for other folks, how they can realize the damage that they've done to Black people, and for our people, what we can do as a collective to try to make this happen. I'm glad to have with us in conversation. And Richard, I might get you to kind of take over the reins of the wagon, because one of our systems are down and I got to get this back up. So I'm going to introduce our guest, and we're going to get started in the conversation. That's all that's important right now. Our guest this evening, professor of public policy, African and African-American studies, economics, and the director of the Samuel DuBose Center on Social Equity at Duke University. Dr. William Sandy Darity is with us this evening. Also, his partner and wife, writer, folklorist, founder, and director of the arts consulting practice Artifactual, A. Christian Mullen, is with us this evening. And good evening to you both. Can you hear me?
Good evening.
How are you,
yes,
sir?
Yes, good. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for having us on.
I'm happy
to. We're very, very, very pleased to join you in this conversation.
I'm happy to have you for the first time, Ms. Mullen, and you back for the second time, I think, Dr. Darity, or maybe the third.
I think it's the second, but it might be the third.
Okay. All right.
Good to be back.
Dr. Darity, before we get started with our conversation this evening, let's go back, because you you wrote a book a while ago, Persistent Disparity, Race and Economics, Inequality in the United States since 1945. But you've always, in fact, when we had you on the program before, we were going over statistics and things like that to show where economically reparations could be accomplished in this country. This is the first book that I'm aware of where you do a whole historical overview on paper of our experience here. Am I right or am I wrong before I continue?
I think that this book is perhaps the most comprehensive treatment
Good.
Of the American historical record.
Okay.
And I say the American historical record because that is what this book is about. It's about America's history, because America's history is so intimately interwoven with the trajectory of injustices that have been inflicted on Black folks.
Yes. The reason I'm asking that is because I want you to explain to the listening audience why you put this together at this particular time, or was it your wife's idea to put this book together? Because I might be asking the wrong person this question.
I don't know. We might each give slightly different answers.
Go ahead.
But the story that I'd like to offer concerns an economist who's based in Philadelphia, Richard F. America,
okay.
who about 30 years ago asked me to write the introduction to a volume that he was editing, in which he had gathered a set of essays from economists trying to measure how much a reparations program should actually cost. And at the time, while I thought that reparations certainly was justified morally, I was so convinced that it was an impossibility that I told Richard that I didn't think I was the right person to write the introduction for the book. And his response was, read the essays, write the introduction, and say whatever you want to say. So I agreed, and I read the essays. And the more that I read, the more I became convinced that reparations was something that we needed to pursue, even if the odds of getting it were long. And I would say in the present moment, the odds are still long, but I'm really stunned, as Brother Richard is, by the degree of attention that reparations is currently getting. So I would say it's been about 30 years that I've been focused on this. I think what occurred was I was giving a talk in Chapel Hill one day, and an editor from the University of North Carolina Press actually heard the talk and suggested that that I do a book. And I was absolutely convinced that the best person to write the book with me was Kirsten Mullen, who shares my view that all Black folklore is true, but she's also a passionate student of history. And so we crafted the book accordingly. Kirsten, you might want to talk about how long it took us.
Well, look, it has been a long time coming. It's been at least 7 years since we began. And, you know, I think the process has been a fascinating one for us. I mean, we've not written steadily on the book for 7 years, but we started this adventure 7 years ago. And in a lot of ways, I think the universe has kind of morphed with us. You know, the internet has developed significantly in that period of time. I know absolutely historical collections, archival collections that were not available online have become available in that period of time. And then there's, because people are able to communicate so quickly and to large numbers of folks, not just in their communities, but around the world, we have benefited from the groundswell of support for this movement. That has both encouraged us and also, you know, provided some guidance in some cases of where to look for information. You know, not only individuals who've come forward to share their own stories, but also as we have presented, you know, different aspects of this topic at, you know, academic conferences, but also at public libraries and other cultural institutions. You know, individuals have come up to us and, you know, suggested that we consider, you know, different collections. So it's been, you know, the process itself has evolved. Our own thinking about reparations has evolved. And then, of course, very recently, for the first time in my memory, we have American politicians who actually have been talking about reparations. I mean, this was like, you know, a verboten topic, and you just did not bring up the R word. But we had, you know, for the first time, you know, Democratic candidates for presidency talking about, you know, the need to correct, erase, or in some way move the needle on this Black-white wealth gulf.
From what I understand, the book is broken down into three areas. The links monetarily to historical wrongs, assessing the literal and figurative cost of justice denied for 155 years since the end of the Civil War, and the last portion of the book, both of you talk about a detailed roadmap for an effective reparations program. Dr. Darney and Ms. Mullen, and I'm asking you this, Ms. Mullen, because I want you to kind of be first. I know that you're a folklorist and you've been contributing or contributed to the museum down in Washington, D.C., so I would say that you're an historian also. Let's start with that period of Reconstruction. I think that's an interesting period. Me and Richard talk about this a lot on the program because it was a period in our experience here when we were finally able to get to our feet, so to speak, and get some type of balance. And the rug was snatched out, almost like you literally snatch a rug out from under somebody. I want to start there because I think it's pivotal in this discussion and our experience. And I want to read this to kind of jumpstart the conversation, because I'm looking at this. We've always, you know, black folks have always discussed the 40 acres and, you know, the things that were talked about during the initial discussions of Reconstruction or the initial implementation. But let me read this to kind of jumpstart the discussion. The U.S. government temporarily implemented Reconstruction 1865 to 1877, but quickly changed its mind. 1870 to 1900, the government gave away 500 million acres of land. Most went to corporations and speculators. Under the Homestead Act during that same period, gave European settlers 48 million acres of land. Under the home, and I'm sorry, let me, because I'm going to have to pass the mic to Brother Richard so I can get this technical situation fixed, but it's no problem. Under the Homestead Act, which gave citizens or future citizens or future European citizens up to 160 acres of public land, provided they live on it, improve it, and pay a small registration fee. The government granted more than 270 million acres of land while the law was in effect. The law remained active for 124 years until it was repealed in 1976. So during the same period, when they were talking about black folks getting 40 acres in a mule, under the Homestead Program, they were giving white settlers 160 acres and gave over 48 million acres away during this program, and according to this published report, over 500 million acres between the years of 1870 to 1900. So what is that saying about their the government's honesty, even in addressing the wrongs during that period? And either one of you can start.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I very much appreciate that quote. I believe it was Martin Luther King Jr. who was talking about these land grants to whites, or what Neil Kashkari, who is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis, calls free equity. But yes, Black Americans were promised 40 acres and a mule. And these, you know, we feel very strongly that had our forebears been given those land grants, that we might not be having this conversation today. You know, if they had received that gift of land, or been allowed to purchase it at reasonable rates, and importantly, also been protected, you know, if they had had the right to vote, if they had had the protection of the Union Army, if they had had the protection of the legal system, and been able to hold on to and in great likelihood pass down that land across the generations, we would be having a very different kind of conversation today. But yes, we, and in our book From Here to Equality, in the chapter on the seven mystic years, we talk at length about, you know, all of the amazing things that happened during that brief period when Black men were given the right to vote. But this is also a period when, you know, many other forces were at work to reverse the benefits, to reverse the progress that happened during Reconstruction. This is a period when, you know, black men were elected to public office. This is a period when public schools were open to black children.
And white children,
in right, in the South. That really hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. So you had black legislators pushing for it. But at the same time, you know, 1866 is when the Ku Klux Klan is founded, right? And so, you know, throughout this period of Reconstruction, you know, some elements of the Klan were literally, you know, wiping out individuals who, you know, whose recollection of recent events, you know, differed from their own. Now, this is the period when the Lost Cause is happening. So you have these two strains happening. You have Reconstruction, and then you have this whole lost cause narrative being constructed. So you have, you know, Black people actively fighting and their allies working with them, and then you have a group of white people who are engaged in this process of forgetting, you know, what just happened, you know, forgetting what slavery was about, forgetting the role that we played in white accumulation of wealth, you know, due to our labors. And, you know, this was not a process that we were really able to control. You know, we talk at length about this whole kind of dismemory project. You know, you have these activities growing out of alongside, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. This is the Supreme Court decision affirming the legality of separate public spaces and conveyances for Blacks and whites. And this is also when you see these monuments being built to Confederate leaders. They're being celebrated not, you know, well, they're being celebrated as heroes and as patriots, and not as the rebels and traitors to the United States that they were. You know, they were secessionists. And but it's a very, you know, it's like for every positive step that Black Americans were making, there were many, many groups that were working to neutralize them, reverse them, you know, put Black people, if not back in slavery, as close to that, you know, as close to that system as they possibly could.
Yeah, the lost cause narrative was the ideological support for a massive white terror campaign that was conducted throughout the latter part of the 19th century and actually carried over into a series of massacres that took place in the 20th century running up through the 1940s. These white massacres took large numbers of Black lives. I think Robert Smalls, the congressional representative from South Carolina, estimated towards the end of the 19th century that during the course of the latter half of the 19th century, after the Civil War, 53,000 Black folks had been killed, and they'd been killed by white terrorists. I mean, straight up murder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this lost cause narrative, which celebrates the Confederacy, is really a bundle of lies, outright lies. And one of the examples of those lies that keeps circulating to this day is the idea that there were very few whites who were slaveholders, not only in the United States, but in the South. I've actually heard somebody claim that 2% of whites in the South actually owned slaves. And this is absolute nonsense. And I'd like to share a portion of our book on this subject.
Go ahead.
If I may.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Certainly. So on page 66 of From Here to Equality, we write the following. In 1860, at the national level, approximately 8% of all American families owned at least one slave. But this seemingly low aggregate national percentage was influenced heavily by the 21 non-Southern states where no families owned slaves during the last days of the antebellum period. By 1860, the Southern experience with slaveholding stood in marked contrast with the Northern pattern. Among the 11 states that seceded from the Union in 1861 to establish the Confederacy, Arkansas, Tennessee, Virginia, North Carolina, Texas, and Louisiana registered at the lower end with at least 20% of white families owning slaves, 20, 25, 26, 28, 28, and 29% respectively. The remaining five states all registered proportions of 34% or higher, peaking at staggering rates of 46 and 49%. In South Carolina and Mississippi, respectively. A still more dramatic indicator of the scope of white engagement with slave ownership is the proportion of white people who were members of slaveholding families. While the national figure was 13% in 1860, one quarter of whites in Arkansas and Tennessee lived in families that owned at least one slave. In Texas, Virginia, and North Carolina, at least one third of whites lived in slave-owning families. And this proportion rose well above 40% in Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and Louisiana, cresting at a fantastic 55 and 57% in Mississippi and South Carolina, respectively. In the Army of Northern Virginia, led by Robert E. Lee, soldiers who owned slaves in their own name or lived in families where slaves were owned constituted about 40% of the enlistees. Because of backward and forward linkages from the slave plantation system, arguably the majority of Confederate soldiers had economic ties to slavery, at least as renters of land from employees or being employees of or traders with slaveholders. More than half of the officers were slave owners. And so we conclude, at the onset of the Civil War, Southern whites and slave ownership were intertwined tenaciously.
Wow. Richard, jump in here. Let me, I'm going to take a minute or two. Take your time.
Ms. Marlon, you kind of like open and Dr. Daria, I already had some thoughts on it, but you know, one thing that you mentioned, Ms. Marlon, is about the protection part, which is something I think that we really, once we deal with, even in the present discussion about reparations, we have to be very conscious of, because we see that either the delay of having even the discussion or the backlash is a real thing. And in the cases just you described, the government support or lack of support can be detrimental to it. But the one of the things, the internal memory I wanted to, you know, just tag on about, are not necessarily America's memory, but our memory. Because, you know, when I think of repair, I also think of, you know, what we must continue in our own narrative. Let me ask you this way on that memory part, and both of you, as you develop the book, do you see that Black people have like really kept a generational record of just the whole question about what had happened at that moment, the trauma that was created, and you know the effects of it. And before I get into a number question, but do you see, as you were putting together the book and doing the research, do you see that we have actually maintained our own narrative?
Well, I think there's a lot of variation, you know. I grew up in a household, you know, where race was like had a place at the table. We were always talking about race in my family. You know, my mother took my sister and me to a march when I was, you know, not even 10 years old. My grandfather, Lowell Paxton Mitchell, was a Baptist pastor, and he was very much involved in the National Interdenominational Alliance. We grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, and I remember that first march was just days after the Episcopal priest and social justice activist Jonathan Myrick Daniels was murdered in August 1965 in Hainesville, Alabama. You know, Father Daniels was attempting to protect Black 17-year-old voter registration organizer Ruby Sales. She had been one of the members of the marches from Selma to Montgomery. So this volunteer county deputy, you know, Tom Coleman, shot him, right? And Coleman was the clerk at the local store. The group had, you know, gone to purchase, you know, a cold drink, right? But I can remember my mother explaining to my sister and me why we were going to the march. And now I also recall that there were not, you know, very many Black people who were in that march. You know, I remember she was working at a public school at the time, Amanda F. McCoy School. Her principal was a man named Robert E. Starr. And he said to my mother, you know, I can't protect you if you march. The administration has told me that I should fire you if you march. And I remember she talked to, you know, my grandparents, and they said, well, you know, we will stand with you. We will support you if you do this. And so she did. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was kind of, you know, the way we grew up. And we were always talking about, you know, why things were so different for the Black people that we knew in our community. I grew up in, you know, a community of working poor Black people. Actually, I shouldn't say that, because there were people on our street, not us, but there were people on our street who did own their homes. But it was also clear to me that, you know, these are really smart, hardworking, innovative people. And yet they did not have the kinds of material possessions, you know, were not able to send their kids to the kind of schools that we saw, you know, white kids and white families, you know, going to in our city, and certainly not on television. And I was always, you know, asking, well, what is that about? You know, and my family would be really clear and say, this is about racism. This is about discrimination. You know, it's not about some deficiency in us. The deck is stacked against us. But I, you know, I think that kind of conversation varied tremendously from family to family.
I was going to say that Ralph Ellison, I think I'm paraphrasing this roughly correctly, said something to the effect of, I'm not ashamed to have come from slaves. I'm ashamed that I was ever ashamed. Mm-hmm. And I think that the shaming dimension is very important. I think that there are many families where our ancestry and heritage and lineage that's connected to enslavement in the United States is something that is an object of shame. And I think that one of the things that we hope can be achieved by From Here to Equality is our assertion that a reparations program that comes from the United States federal government that is directed at Black Americans who are descendants of folks who were enslaved in the United States will spur more and more people to try to study and learn about their own family's heritage. There's a portion of the book where we talk about the complaint that's frequently given that slavery is something that happened so long ago. Right. And we provide a set of family histories there from people who were willing to share them with us that demonstrates that in one case, the individual who told us her story, who is still living, her father was born into slavery. So she's like the first generation out of slavery. But there, in most families, it's 4 to 5 generations out. But if you think about it from a generational perspective, it really isn't that long ago.
My own grandmother, my maternal grandmother's father, was born enslaved.
Yeah.
And you know, she just passed a few years ago.
It's so important because, and we will get to that hopefully later in our discussion, because one of the remedies you get requires, if I'm not mistaken, that's in the book, that requires us to kind of do that, you know, if we're just as a consideration. But Dr. Derry, this is the thing that, you know, because we use the term wealth all the time, and I seen or heard, I don't know if it was in the book, but I heard where you made reference that as of right now, America is, and I don't know if I'm using the right term, produces $100 trillion or has wealth that is defined at $100 trillion. Is that correct? Is that how you would phrase that? Is it America $100 trillion worth of wealth?
Yes. It's not production. It's the net value of all of the property held by all Americans. And so that's actually 1/3 of the global wealth. I mean, that's how extraordinarily wealthy the United States is. And then out of that figure, about 90% of that wealth is held by white Americans. This contrasts sharply with the black share, where, you know, black Americans are approximately 13% of the nation's population, but have less than 3% of the nation's wealth. And so there's some other manifestations of that. The fact that 25% of white Americans have a net worth in excess of $1 million, but only 4% of black Americans have a net worth in excess of $1 million. What's the other really striking figure? 50% of whites actually have the equivalent amount of wealth as all black Americans taken together. So, and there are 4 billionaires who have as much wealth as about 90% of all black Americans. So this is really critical, because there's a distinction between wealth and income that is important to emphasize, where income is a flow of resources that are usually tied primarily to our earnings. But wealth is the difference between what we own and what we owe. It is the net value of our property and the difference between our assets and our debts. And the larger that sum is, the greater our capacity to weather storms like the harsh effects of the depression that's been created by COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Or in so-called normal times, the effects of a job loss or a major medical emergency in a family. Wealthier families don't even have to worry about it because they've got the resources to cover them during those kinds of trials. Wealthier families can provide their offspring with quality schooling. They can make sure that they live in neighborhoods where there are sound amenities and presumably less of a likelihood of being attacked by the police. And they can transfer those resources across generations. And this capacity is something that has been systematically denied Black Americans. And this is why we need reparations as a mechanism for eliminating these differences in racial wealth.
And, you know, and the reason why I just wanted to, you know, like maybe excavate a little more as far as, and you gave us the number, the general numbers, you know, the aggregate amount, what does wealth constitute? Because when reparations has come, if we're talking about intergenerational path, we have to make decisions of how appropriate decisions, correct me if I'm wrong, of how we deal with the whatever we get. Regardless, and your policies that you outline in the book are helpful. But even then, in order to be able to define what wealth is and then be able to pass it to the next generation. So what I'm asking is, what constitute wealth that once we have, is it, you said it's not income, but we usually are aware of income. So it's not just getting money or dollars. Is about getting other things. What are those other things?
No, actually, it could be money or dollars, but it would be money or dollars in a form of assets that are not immediately spent. Mm-hmm. If we think about it, the wealthiest people are individuals who not only own homes, which I think we overemphasize as a component of wealth, but they usually own real estate. They own financial assets. Mm-hmm. They might own businesses or corporations. And so that's a variety of things, but we can translate all of those things into some sort of monetary value. That's what we call your net worth. And we could give people the equivalent or rough equivalent sums of money to the value of land, corporations, and the value of financial assets. We could give them financial assets also, which they may not be able to spend as quickly. And so if we're concerned about wealth building and not wanting people to consume whatever they receive immediately, then it's the way in which we deliver the assets that would be critical. I think we propose in the book that you could provide people with an endowment, mm-hmm. and they could, on an annual basis, spend off of the interest from that endowment, so they could use that for consumption purposes, and that would supplement their income. But they could only dip into the principal if they had a project or a proposal that could be approved by an agency that was elected by the eligible recipients of reparations.
And that proposal, which sounds good, and some of us, you know, kind of even in our personal family are trying to construct those kind of structures, you know, whether you call it a trust and whatever, to try to deal with this intergenerational transmission. But the you know, and when you said that an agency, again, looking at the internal repair and the importance of our being clear of our own history, because I think it was the Freedmen's Bureau, Ms. Mullen, that came into existence, or the Freedmen's Bank. And the experience that we had in this bank, which was supposed to be able to harness our income, and be able to work in our best interest, and then find out that it didn't. Maybe you can elaborate on what you discovered in that period of the Freedmen's Bank experience.
So absolutely, this was a situation where, you know, Black Americans were encouraged to deposit their savings and their earnings in the Freedmen's Bank. And, you know, many people assumed that those funds were backed by the federal government. You know, they always had the American flag, you know, hanging outside these banks. The bank registers would have pictures of Abraham Lincoln, General Grant, even General Oliver O. Howard, who was the head of the Freedmen's Bureau. Their photos would appear on the bank registers. And so it gave the impression that all of these transactions were being monitored by and backed, most importantly, secured by funds from the U.S. Treasury. They even replaced, at one point, the majority of the white tellers with Black tellers to increase Black, you know, the Black depositors' confidence in the bank. But the officers of the bank were almost never Black Americans, right? And even though the trustees and the directors of the bank were sworn to protect those investments, those holdings, and they were forbidden to you know, make borrowings themselves, and certainly to bring in not didn't have junk bonds, but to bring in, you know, loans that were not well secured, you know, for projects that were underdeveloped. This is absolutely what happened. And you know, they were even bringing in, you know, loans from other banks that they were familiar with, loans that they knew were not well developed, and allowed the Freedmen's Bureau Bank to take the losses on those accounts. And so, you know, ultimately there was, I think the financier that kind of brought down the banks, kind of like a domino effect. You had the J. Cook Company, and the Seneca Sandstone Company, these huge kind of unsecured loans. And none of this would have happened if these white trustees had not allowed it to happen. Exactly. And so you have the confluence of these unsecured loans and so many of them. And then there's a panic in 1876 where there's kind of a run on the bank, right? And so it's just a disastrous, it's a horrible situation for Black Americans.
I mean, is the estimate that that Black depositors lost something in the vicinity of $4 million?
I think that's right. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. And so it's at this point.
And that's in the 1870s.
Yeah, back in those days. And so at this point, they, you know, the heads of the bank recruit Frederick Douglass to come in. So after the ship is, you know, on fire, after the building's on fire, they recruit Frederick Douglass to come in. And he is just, you know, not aware of how dire the situation is. He's thinking, you know, I want to serve my country any way I can. I want to be an asset. I want to be a good advisor to Black Americans. But after he takes on the role and he begins to examine the books, then he sees what horrible shape the banks are in. And he actually invests $10,000 of his own money, you know, trying to stanch, you know, the losses. But he loses that money
himself.
I mean, it's just a disaster.
Yeah.
And, you know, people wonder why, you know, Black Americans have such a hard time trusting the federal government, right? You know, when they are placed in these precarious situations completely unnecessarily.
Yeah. And that's why it's so important. Excuse me, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that the Freedmen's Bank was an artifact of the Freedmen's Bureau.
Mm. Yes, but.
And the other failure of the Freedmen's Bureau was the failure to actually execute the provision of the 40-acre land grants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, the reason why I think it's so important that we, as people, you know, dive into your book and look at the historical the historical development of reparations and understand, you know, the policy recommendations that you propose. Again, what we have to be very much conscious of as we advocate demand reparations, you know, and government redress. So, you know, that sticks really. I think that also has to be really emphasized. Another thought question came in the sense of, as y'all were doing the research on this, of the research of the reparation movement. I like y'all to develop
Richard,
that.
Do me a favor, yeah. Before you jump to the that area, because that's kind of moving forward. Let me stay kind of where you're at when you're talking about that period. And before I ask that question, I want to inform the listening audience that we're in conversation with Professor of Public Policy, African American and African Studies, Economics, and the Director of the Samuel DuBose Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University, William Sandy Darity, and also his wife is with us, writer, folklorist, and founder, director of the Arts Consulting Practice of Artifactual, Ms. Kristen Mullen. We're in conversation about the book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, and we're talking about the book and related topics. And Dr. Darity and Ms. Mullen, this is something that came up when we had a guest on about a month ago, Sean Rochester, who wrote the book, The Black Tax. And he talked about, let me read this to you, because it directly relates to something that you talk about in the book about the after effects, or when you talk about the links of the historical damage and injustices from 155 years since the Civil War. In 1860, the Southern plantation supplied 75% of the world's cotton. So that global industry was tremendous for the United States, not just for the South. So when you had the after effects, or after the Civil War, when a lot of our ancestors weren't on those plantations anymore, the global economy or stranglehold that the U.S. had on the world was disrupted at best. So when we see Jim Crow, peonage, the prison system or prison slavery, sharecropping that existed for almost 100 years after that, and some black folks look at that as some type of anomaly or stain on the United States history. But if you look at it, it really was a part or an extension of what the United States was trying to accomplish. Because they benefited from Jim Crow, the peonage, sharecropping, because it allowed that institution of at least cotton and other industries before it was industrialized to continue, even though it was disrupted somewhat during the period of Reconstruction. Talk about that from the monetary standpoint of how much of an effect our people had on just the cotton industry. I'm not talking about some of the others, but just the cotton industry that was disrupted.
Well, slave-grown cotton was instrumental to American economic development. And as you pointed out, it was significant not just for the South, but for the entire country. There's a section of From Here to Equality where we talk specifically about the importance of the cotton trade and New York City's development. Okay. And you could argue that New York City and the cotton trade were close siblings, and that the wealthiest individuals in New York City typically had some sort of connection to the cotton sector in the United States. And so so it was not just a Southern phenomenon. I think the state of Connecticut also, because of its textile sector, had critical connections to slave-grown cotton. So, yes, I mean, our forced labor, or our ancestors' forced labor, was actually critical for the entire country's economic development, lay at the heart of it. And the key point that you make about the chain of atrocities that followed slavery and followed the Reconstruction era, the 100 years of legal segregation, peonage, sharecropping, and the like, also contributed to economic development and economic advantage
Yes.
for those people who were in the exploiting positions. And I think that the Jim Crow era in particular is one of the key reasons why we talk about the case for reparations as not being a case that's limited to the harms of slavery, but it must take into account what occurred afterward. And so we argue that there are three phases of American history that are relevant to the case for Black reparations. The first is slavery. The second is the Jim Crow period and the white terror campaigns that accompanied it. And then the third are the array of atrocities that are still continuing to this day in the aftermath of the passage of the civil rights legislation in the mid-1960s. And so here we would include mass incarceration. We would include police executions of unarmed Blacks, the persistence of discrimination in credit, hiring, and housing. And then, of course, the fundamental characteristic of racial inequality in the United States that we've been talking about, the enormous racial wealth gap.
You know, what we'll do, we'll take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the discussion. You can get involved, and if we got a full board here, Richard.
Yeah, I see.
You can get involved, too, in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're going to take a brief break. I think we might be having some technical difficulties on TuneIn, but we do have other areas where you can get involved. You can tune into the Black Talk Radio Network and catch the program live. And if any of you can't, the program will be up for podcast, and you'll be able to access the program in its entirety. So don't worry about it if you can't hear it on TuneIn, but you do have other options where you can tune it in. Just go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, and you'll be able to hear the program live. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can be part of the discussion by dialing 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. Abibitumi.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. Abibitumi.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global KometsU Black family, to join your interconnected KometsU Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
You all are really to be admired. And I want you to know that you have my moral support. I'm going to be praying for you. I'm going to be coming back to see you. And we are going to be demanding when we go to Washington that something be done, and done immediately, about these conditions. At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check. I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. Somebody
said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back. The time for an awakening is 8:12 here in the city of Philadelphia, and we're joined in conversation tonight by Professor of Public Policy of African and African American Studies, Economics, and the Director of the Samuel DuBose Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University, William A. Sandy Darity, is with us this evening. And also with us is his wife, writer, folklorist, and founder, director of the arts consulting practice of Artifactual, A. Christian Mullen. We're in discussion about the book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. You can get involved in the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. And again, if any listeners can't hear us on the TuneIn app, you can always tune over to Black Talk Radio Network and pick up the program. And if anybody didn't hear the program in its entirety, it'll be up for podcast shortly after this program is over. And you can check on the website, timeforanawakening.com. You can go to blacktalkradionetwork.com and pull the podcast down if you miss any of the program tonight. But again, if any listeners are trying to tune in on the TuneIn app, just jump over to blacktalkradionetwork.com and you can hear the program in its entirety. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir.
Before we go to the caller, I think you had something else that you want to throw out there.
I wanted them to develop. I know in the book you developed the history of the reparations movement, and I wanted to outline that for us. And also, I was wondering, as y'all were doing the research on that, was there a cross fertilization from generation to generation in the sense of an individual one movement? And moment and movement, you discovered there were individuals that were part of that were a part of the next movement, and at another moment in history as it relates to the reparation movement.
Yeah, I think Kirsten and I did discover that. We learned a great deal from a book that was written by Mary Frances Berry, which is a biography of Callie House. I believe the book is called My Face is Black is True. Mm-hmm. And Callie House was a political activist who was from the grassroots. She made her living taking in laundry, if I recall correctly. And in the latter half of the 19th century, she developed a movement to try to get pension funds for the formerly enslaved. And so this was a reparations effort on her part. She was able to mount a movement that consisted of, I think, in excess of 300,000 people. So in terms of the connection to subsequent generations, her movement was undermined by the federal government using their vaunted technique of bringing postal fraud charges mm-hmm. against somebody. And I think she was in jail for maybe upwards of 3 years after they convicted her. But these charges were trumped up, and it was a mechanism for undercutting her efforts. But it's interesting because the members of her movement subsequently became cornerstone members of the Garvey movement.
Mm-hmm.
And within the context of the Garvey movement, there was advocacy for Black reparations. And then subsequent to that, after they brought Garvey down with postal fraud charges,
the same charges, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same charges. Queen Mother Audley Moore becomes a central figure in advocating reparations. And it's her efforts that I think are the precursor to organizations like NCOBRA. And the folks who form the movement with Queen Mother Audley Moore, including Queen Mother herself, were heavily influenced by the Garvey movement, and many of them came out of the Garvey movement. So there was a tradition that evolved about support for reparations that was carried across generations. I'm not sure if anything you want to add to that.
I was thinking about the Black Manifesto.
With James Forman.
James Forman.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
So. There are any number of individuals who were focused on reparations efforts. And in Forman's case, this is an activist who was in New York City who wanted to, his thinking was that religious organizations had a tremendous impact on the slave trade. And just the growth of the slavery movement, and that they were culpable and should be made to pay reparations directly to Black Americans. And so they came up with a figure, buying back the dollar amount, and they actually did receive some funds.
Yeah, but it was like about 1% of what they were asking.
Much smaller than what they were asking.
Yeah.
And out of that, though, came a Black think tank.
Yeah.
This was
the Black Economic Research Center.
Yeah. So there were individuals.
Robert Brown,
who was involved there.
And I think Robert Brown published the first significant article on reparations in the American Economic Review. And so it preceded some work that I did with Dania Frank on reparations that was also published there.
So they were collecting data on, Black economic wealth and income.
Yeah.
And they also, generated proposals.
And they created the Review of Black Political Economy, which exists to this day.
Right.
Yeah.
I used to love to look at that at one point, but it seemed like be able to look in the Black Economic Political Economy magazine. I think it was a magazine that was
published. Yeah, it was a journal. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was going to say, though, in the present moment, I think a lot of the momentum for the reparations movement is being carried by another grassroots movement that has emerged primarily through social media, American Descendants of Slavery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought that up because as I looked over that and I heard y'all speak on that history and those connections, the thing that struck me, and I want y'all to, help me erase it if it's a wrong, that the reparations movement has always been a grassroots working class movement, saying that there is whether it be the Black administrative class or institutional class, didn't really advocate for reparations like working people. Would that be a fair assessment, or should it be packaged a different kind of way?
I think that's true for the most part. There certainly were, Black abolitionists who, many of whom had been free, born into families where they were, they were not enslaved. I mean, these are the people who were able to fund the movement, to get the orators, from city to city, buying their train fare, and to publish the tracks, to publish the broadsides and the posters that were distributed, you know, in the cities in anticipation of their arrival and their presentations. But it is absolutely the case that, you know, Black people and their supporters, they were the first abolitionists. I mean, they were leading with their hearts and with their bodies. I mean, they were, you know, walking off and running away from these plantations and then coming back to get their families.
But I do think it's true that many Blacks who were better positioned, who had legitimacy or credibility in white eyes, frequently have opposed reparations.
Mm. And that's what makes this moment, you know, especially with the number, especially after the 70s, the number of Black elected officials that we have and how H.R. 40 has been languishing and, you know, in committee for so long. And as you mentioned, you know, with this new momentum has been able to at least get that group of politicians to, you know, kind of push it, even get the hearing. And that's why I think it's important. But again, I'm always trying to hopefully run the conversation for us to recognize our responsibility. I mean, that we have been pushing this. We know we're due. And we know
that's absolutely right. Yeah.
You know,
yeah. I would add that I think one of the barriers that we face is the high degree of internal resistance to reparations. So I think about 35% of Black Americans do not endorse reparations. And to me, that's stunning. I don't even know how you can begin to wrap your mouth around the idea that reparations are not merited by Black Americans.
Well, you know what? I think it's a lot of factors involved in that, Dr. Dowdy and Ms. Mullen, and some of them relate right back to slavery, but that might be part of another conversation. But
say this too. You know, I think just as was the case with the civil rights movement, when you had, you know, a wide array of Black organizations supporting the movement, you know, we needed everyone. You know, everyone had a role to play. There were individuals whose livelihoods were absolutely tied to their white employers, white benefactors. But some of those folks actually raised funds to get people out of jail. Some of those folks were involved in feeding civil rights workers. We needed all of these people. You know, we don't all come to an understanding. We don't all come to a realization of what needs to happen at the same time. And I think there is absolutely room in the movement for, you know, all of us. You know, one of the reasons that we wrote the book, From Here to Equality, was to try to broaden the conversation, you know, to talk not just about, you know, to expand the conversation beyond, you know, people saying, oh, you know, we're deserving, but not necessarily having the undergirding of the history. You know, we wanted to make the case, you know, and we're not neutral at all. I mean, this is a piece of advocacy that we have constructed. But part of the reason for that was to be able to give people material so that they could say, oh, wait, look here. They don't have to believe us. They can look at the references, look at the footnotes that we have supplied, and then do additional research so that they can have the confidence in this this information and the confidence in this movement.
Yeah.
But I think people come to...
What is it, advocacy ammunition?
Advocacy ammunition, precisely.
Yeah, yeah.
But we come to our understanding in very different ways. Some of us have personal experience. Some of us, you know, there are a lot of people who don't necessarily register what we might think is the proper response to their own experience of injustice, but they will become incensed when they see someone else suffering. So there are just lots of things that, you know, there are lots of moments that, that come together, I think, in a movement. You know, in the work that we've done looking at successful reparations movements around the world, invariably, there were groups that many people thought were righteous and were forward-looking, even, you know, prescient and brave. And then there were groups that folks thought were not to be trusted. You know, who are these people? How dare they come forth? You know, it takes a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different, you know, not as people to be willing to put themselves out there for the cause. And, you know, far be it from me to say exactly what mm-hmm. each individual's contribution should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's right. I think that, the problem I have is not people who are silent supporters, but people who vociferously oppose. Mm. And particularly struck by the people who say, you know, receipt of reparations would maintain their victim status. Okay. Well, if you are a victim, you merit compensation. But I always say to those folks, well, we're not forcing you to take reparations once they're available. So if you feel it does you psychological trauma to receive reparations, then simply don't accept it.
Simple as that.
We're in conversation tonight with Professor of Public Policy, African-American Studies, African and African-American Studies, Economics, and Director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University, William Sandy Darity, and his wife, writer, folklorist, and founder of Director of the Arts Consulting Practice, Artifactual, A. Kristen Mullen. The book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. You can get it on Amazon. Also, we have a link for it on the Time for an Awakening website. You can also click on that, and it'll direct you to it, how to purchase the book.
Please, everybody, purchase the book. Stop playing.
Let's go to some callers. Let's start out in Virginia. Let's go to. Are you there?
There.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, we're here. Yes.
Oh, caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? Let's put them. I don't know what's going on there. Let's go to Baltimore, Maryland. Caller. What's your name? Where you calling from?
Baltimore, Maryland.
Yes. 443. 443.
Yes, that's me.
Okay, go ahead. Your question?
As I've listened to some of the discussion over reparations, the question has been, how is it dispersed, to whom, and by what quanta? And I just stop and look at all the people who are suddenly claiming their African American heritage and wonder if maybe they see the writing on the wall or they're trying to get in now, and what your thoughts are about that.
So that's an excellent question. So for us, there are two criteria, basically. These are, you know, American citizens who can prove that they have at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. And to get to the heart of your question, I think, at least 12 years prior to the onset of the reparations program or the passage of legislation enacting a study commission for reparations program, the individual mm-hmm. self-identified as Black, African-American, or Negro, right? I mean, they could choose to reveal their census data. Mm-hmm. Some states require you to indicate, you know, race on your driver's license or other government mm-hmm. documents. But they would absolutely have to have identified as Black 12 years prior to the onset of a reparations program or the enactment of a legislative study commission on reparations.
Okay, but you're not. Are you using one drop rule, Are you, you know,
no,
in terms
no,
of,
no, not at no, all, not at all.
Self-identification.
Self-identification and the genealogical okay. evidence of yeah. having an has an enslaved ancestor in the United States.
Yeah.
Okay. And if, like, I'm black. I mean, my family's black. They're all black. They've been black for generations with various admixtures coming in.
For the record,
just so you know where my position is. So I just noticed that there are more and more people who are claiming African American ancestry, and I just hate to see us get into sort of the $5 Indian situation where some people are Native American.
That's not an issue because they would have to establish that they had an ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. So mm-hmm. it's not a question of phenotype. It's not a question of any kind of DNA testing for us. It's a matter of whether or not you have a lineage that connects you to folks who were enslaved in the United States and whether you have embedded yourself in the black community in terms of your sense of identity.
Okay, because I guess I just stop and realize that it's sort of like, you know, I would consider myself 100% black. I don't even use African American. I just use black American.
Caller, let me ask you a question before we move on. When you say a 5-cent Indian or whatever, and what exactly are you talking about when somebody claims to be black?
In determination of Native American heritage, it's based on are you associated with a tribe and what percenta, what quanta you are. But there were people who back in the who historically bought into being Native Americans because they wanted certain benefits of it. And then as it continued down the historical line, people who bought access to who bought into being a Native American, white people used to buy into it. And now they're considered like full-blooded Native American because they bought papers at some time in the past. So I'm just saying that was an interesting criteria. And as we're setting up the criteria for myself, because, you know, I have friends who are now coming to me telling me that they're actually African American, that they've done a genealogical test that shows that they're 10%, but they have never considered themselves African American, but now they're starting to claim it. So I, you know, and as a person,
if we don't have reparations within 12 years, then they can get away with this.
Okay.
But the reason for the 12-year condition, and we could modify that if it's necessary. The reason for the 12-year condition is to avoid exactly what you're talking about mm-hmm. is people who, recognize that reparations is going to be available, and then they decide that they're going to be considered African-American, black, or Negro. And so we wanted to make sure that when that kind of declaration was made, it was made outside of the window of time when people might have any expectation that they could receive a benefit from being black, Negro, African-American. Yeah.
Thank you for your call. Thank you for your call. Mm-hmm. Let's go to 447.
I just wanted to add it because I thought when I heard that criteria, I thought it was really, really important, especially the part about proving, you know, ancestral lineage directly to enslavement. Because what it requires, as I hear both of you say, that isn't about phenotyping. And even that back and forth we hear all the time, you know, everybody saying they're Indians and some actually getting, going through the process. And we've seen, in over the years reports, but the point of doing that genealogical research of being able to actually document. And it goes back to what you, were saying, Ms. Mullen about the, you know, memory, because that work we should be doing. The DNA test is easy. But the genealogical work, there's institutions that we should be doing that because in that is our historical narrative. And I think that that's just important. And that's a, that's a real solid criteria in my mind that gets past this. I used to call myself, or for those who just came here as just recent immigrants or any of that, that you have to be able to show that documentation of a ancestor that was directly involved in slavery. What's important is, to me, is that we have to do that work and excavate those stories that we can be able to tell.
Listen. One of the things that we've talked about in our book, From Here to Equality, which the University of North Carolina Press published, is
this is about the agency?
Yes, thank you. That that the Reparations Commission project includes a federal agency that provides genealogical assistance. That could, because we know that, you know, as a caller 443 said, you know, there may be people who suddenly want to describe themselves as Black, but they will not be able to substantiate that, you know, with historical records. But this is a process that can be greatly aided by professional researchers.
Yeah.
And
DNA testing might be able to establish that you have African ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
But it will not establish that you have enslaved ancestors,
right.
Because, you know, we need the bones, right? We don't have the bones, so we have to do genealogical work.
Right.
Let's go to 447. 447? 447, are you there? Let's put them back on hold. Let's go to San Francisco. San Francisco? Hello? Let's put them back on hold. Let's go to 919. 919, are you there? 919? Durham, North Carolina? Let's put them back on hold. 919 again. Another call from Durham. 919, are you there? Let's go to Mobile or Livingston, Alabama. 205. 205? 205, are you there? Let's put them on hold. Let's go to Orlando, Florida. 407, 407. Extension 407, are you there?
Does that mean I get to ask another question?
Yeah, let's put them on hold. You know, Dr. King, in that clip that we played, said that nobody else can do this for us. No Lincolnian or Johnsonian civil rights bill, that we have to do this. We have to be involved in the liberation of our people. My hat's off to Dr. Darity and Ms. Mullen for the work that they have been doing on this and documenting it, showing a blueprint or a way that in their mind that we can achieve this. But we all, see, we can't sit around as people and look for Dr. Darity's and Ms. Mullen's to do all the work for us. We have to be involved. We have to get involved in organizations. Join organizations in your city. If no one's out there, start one. You know, I love listeners to the program, but I love people to be involved with conversation and putting their ideas out here so people can hear their ideas and we can discuss them. It's good to have listeners, but come on, folks, let's get involved. If I come to you and you don't have nothing to say, just say, well, I don't have nothing to say. I got a question. Just ask anything. Ask how old Dr. Darity is. Just ask a question. Don't just sit there.
No, don't ask that. Because then you have to ask Ms. Mullen. I don't know if that still holds about.
Yeah, well, let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. 502.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. It's a honor and a pleasure to be speaking with you all this evening and to have an opportunity to hear Dr. Darity and Ms. Mullen. Hello, this is Michael Hicks from Louisville, Kentucky. How are you all doing?
How are you, Michael? Good to hear from you, man.
It's great to hear from you. And it's great to hear you speaking about this wonderful book. My question, I want to kind of focus and center on chapter 13.
Brother, it's, you might have a little bit of. Are you in a good? Are you in a good area? Because you, it's a little interference.
That's not him.
On my end.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Continue your conversation. I'm sorry.
Okay. No. Okay. No. That's fine. Yeah. In chapter 13, from here to equality, you provide a roadmap and a number of a prescription in the name of how such a reparations program would be implemented. And one important element of that, you talked about the re-education that would be necessary to teach America all of its history. You said something in particular that struck me, and that was the deconfederization that would be absolutely required of America's history. We have to kind of unlearn as a national body. We have to unlearn the lost cause. Would you be able to speak on that a little bit, please?
Happily. So, you know, the facts of enslavement and the early and sustained efforts of Black abolitionists and their allies were suppressed in favor of a completely different story. You know, this discriminatory policies of the Daughters of the American Revolution, the persistent and ongoing efforts of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, you know, not only to erect monuments and historical markers to the lost cause, as you were saying, but also to, you know, they conducted genealogical research and documented the lives of Civil War veterans, Confederate veterans. And then they lobbied the states to build archives that would become repositories for these men's stories. You know, we have learned about the work from the work of historians Ethan J. Kittle and Blaine Roberts. A fascinating book, Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the South. And, you know, they're talking about, you know, slavery was sort of downplayed by these groups or ignored completely, or it was cast as this kind of benevolent and civilizing institution for Black people and not, you know, the brutal, inhumane institution that shaped who we are as a nation. You know, the DAR, the Daughters of the American Revolution, and the United Daughters of the Confederacy actively lobbied the historians who were writing the textbooks immediately after the Civil War, because those textbooks, for the most part, were accurate initially. But these two women's groups were not pleased with, you know, what was being shared in these books. And so first they attempted to persuade the authors to change their points of view. And when that was not successful, they began to actively blackball them. They they attended a educational association. They identified their friends who were, in some cases, the members' own spouses who were you know, powerful publishers, or who were superintendents of schools, and got them to pull, to withdraw these textbooks in favor of texts that were written, with a point of view that they preferred, the lost cause.
Fascinating.
And in some instances, they actually wrote textbooks themselves. And what is incredible is these textbooks, many of them were in force for at least 75 years and were published and used in public schools into the 1950s and 60s. Now, the equally horrible part of this is, you know, Black schools during this period had the oldest textbooks, right? And so Black American children were exposed to these lost cause narratives deep into the 1950s and 60s because their schools were not given the most recent you know, textbooks when these textbooks were finally examined. And it's not like it was an on-off switch. I mean, there was a period where the textbooks were slightly better. You know, it took decades for them to be, you know, significantly transformed. I mean, some of your listeners may recall as recent as like the 2018 when a Texas textbook, and so Texas and California are two states that have tremendous influence over textbook selection. Large numbers of students and schools, you know, in those districts. But a lot of states that don't have the wherewithal to do their own formal review simply adopt the textbooks that Texas and California select. And so there was a textbook that spoke of Black Black Americans as having come from Africa for job opportunities, seeking opportunities in America.
What insult.
Say that again.
Oh, I was saying, what an insult.
Yes. But not at all, you know, invoking slavery. You know, this was just a, another opportunity.
It was another
immigrant story.
Another immigrant story.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, saying I get really incensed when people say we're a country of immigrants. Mm-hmm. Like, well, no. You know, the Native Americans were here. That's why they're called Native Americans, because they were already here. And there's a big difference between coming to the coming to this country, any country, voluntarily, versus being forced to come in shackles, and then coming and having your labors stolen from you, not just your labors, but your whole life stolen from you. And this is what we were dealing with. I learned about a fascinating memoir. It was written by white historian Charles Dew, who was born in 1937 and is now professor emeritus at Williams College. And his memoir, which is fascinating and disturbing, is called The Making of a Racist, A Southerner Reflects on Family, History, and the Slave Trade. And so he writes in his memoir about having been given a copy of a book called A Youth Confederate Reader. This is by R.M. Smith in 1951 when he was a child. And then he talks at length about how the individual who gave him this tome would question him about it every time that they saw him. So it's like, you know, he was not only, you know, this is not just a gift, you know, of insignificance. You know, it was important to the gift giver that Charles Dew read and understand and, you know, embrace the information that was in the, you know, in this Youth's Confederate Reader.
Indoctrination.
Thank you for your call, brother.
You know, get them while they're young, right? And so it's interesting to note, you know, he's a scholar of American history and presumably had seen many adverts for, you know, slave runaways or and auctions for slaves. But what he claims, the changing moment for him, the epiphany that he had, was in seeing, maybe for the first time, or maybe, you know, seeing this advertisement with new eyes. And the ad was for children. A lot of the he was from Richmond. And Richmond was a huge slave trading destination. Lots of slave auctions took place there, holding pens for slaves. And so this particular advertisement listed the children by weight and height. And so it really touched him. He thought, oh my gosh, it's like they're like, you know, you would talk about a horse being so many hands high or a goat, you know, weighing so many pounds. But it was like you're buying, you know, groceries. And, you know, how many pounds was the chicken? And, you know, and so this was the moment that Charles Dew says made him rethink his whole life. And he began to, you know, try to pinpoint what were the moments throughout his life, his upbringing, when he was being taught what it meant to be someone who venerated the lost cause.
Yeah.
You know, how did he become this person You know, on the one hand, he was thinking of himself perhaps as progressive, mm-hmm. but also recognizing that there was a lot about the way he thought about the world, especially how he thought about Black people, Black Americans, that were straight out of, you know, the Lost Cause narrative and Confederates' view that Black, you know, Black people never should become citizens, and certainly not full citizens in this country, and certainly not have the kinds of the rights that they possessed. But it's fascinating, you know, to see this work. But yes, this whole Dismemory Project, and so the deconfederization, the term that we coined, refers to this process that needs to occur so that we can kind of wind back the clock. You know, in Nazi Germany, folks talk about the denazification. And what they're speaking of here is, you know, it's illegal for individuals to publicly raise the symbols of the Nazis. Whereas in the United States, you see Confederate flags all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And in so many town halls or courthouses, you'll see the photographs and paintings of, you know, the large slaveholders. You'll see, you know, images of people like John Calhoun, you know, who fought so hard to keep Black people enslaved, and then after the Civil War to recreate as much of that institution as he possibly could. You know, I have one of my college roommates, a Black woman in Houston, talked at length about how just dehumanizing it was to go to Robert E. Lee High School in Houston. And she was a member of the marching band, and they wore, Confederate gray. They wore the literal Confederate uniform when they marched, and the school song was, you know, I think Dixie. And she's not alone in that. You know, she was aware of the hypocrisy. She was aware of the history. But I don't know if that was widely the case. But yes, I think it's very important for us to begin to do this research. I mean, we often, you know, will say, especially to whites who, you know, maintain that, you know, their families were not connected to slavery in any way and they never benefited. You know, our suggestion is, you know, perhaps you want to do some research. You may find out that is not, I mean, it's quite likely that you'll discover that was not the case. You know, even if your family, I mean, so many, many, many whites were slave owners or lived in slave owning families.
Yeah.
And many others were involved in the business of policing Black bodies or trading with these slave owning families. You know, they may have, you may have been in a family that produced the sails on the ships that, you know, brought enslaved Africans from the continent, or the barrel that rum or sugar or molasses were transported in.
I mean, if you were an overseer, you wouldn't necessarily own slaves.
Right. But you were absolutely connected to the slave trade.
Right.
And all of the people who did business with them, you know, from the local ministers who, you know, frequently had chapels and church structures on the plantation sites themselves and who received their salaries from these, you know, these the slave owners, to the cobbler who made everyone's shoes. I mean, slavery was indeed a global economy, and no one who was alive during that period really was disconnected economically.
Louisville, thank you for your contribution and your call. Let's go to Buffalo, New York. Buffalo, New York. Buffalo?
Yes, hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
I'm not on speaker. Are you? Do you have me on speaker? It sounds like you're talking in a echo chamber.
Yeah, I am. I don't want to. This is my first time doing this, so I am. I don't want to speak over.
Okay, well, go ahead. Ask your question or make a comment.
I'm listening intently, and And I learned something tonight. I didn't know that the Garvey movement also spoke in reparations. And I didn't know, I forgot the name of the person that preceded Garvey, a woman, I believe.
Callie House.
Yeah. But I think one of the things that a mention was made of the social move of the social media movement that kind of, I hate to say, reignited or put some spark into this reparations debate. One of the things that troubled me from listening to that was the kind of level of vitriol and seemingly anti-immigrant tone that was taken by the social media movement. And it looked as though they were getting funding from some anti-immigration group. But that, you know, let me digress from that a little bit and move on to something perhaps more pertinent here. And that is, I noticed that Sir Hilary Beckles from the Caribbean was able to kind of get some reparations from, I think, the University of Glasgow. Mm-hmm. I noticed that, I think, what do you call that university in Washington, D.C., the Catholic, Georgetown University, different universities throughout the U.S., where ties have been established to slavery, have been trying to do things individually on their own. And one of the things I would like to see happen is that these universities give scholarships to African-American people exclusively, tuition-free. And, you know, so that we kind of get away from some of this, again, vitriol around affirmative action. So I think African-Americans should be given free tuition to any university that had tied with slavery. I'd like to know what your guests may think about that proposal.
All right, and thank you for your call. Don't be a stranger. Call again.
Well, I think we want to avoid vitriol at all costs, and I don't think that our personal view that that reparations in the United States should be directed at folks who are descendants of U.S. slavery is in any way intrinsically an anti-immigrant position. So I just wanted to get that out of the way first. Second thing I wanted to mention here is we are somewhat vehemently opposed to what we refer to as piecemeal reparations that's conducted by individuals or by organizations. At least we are opposed to that as being insofar as we view it as unsatisfactory. So let me step back to what we say should be a central accomplishment of the reparations program, which is the elimination of the racial wealth gap, which would require an injection of an additional $10 to $12 trillion in resources into the Black community. We don't think that projects like the Georgetown University Initiative, and we've actually written extensively on this in a blog that we prepared for the Roosevelt Institute, that these kinds of individual or piecemeal initiatives are not going to make any headway towards closing the racial wealth gap. In fact, I think Georgetown's arrangement that they've proposed, they haven't actually executed it, is to provide $400,000 a year to the descendants of the 272 persons who were sold into the South to keep the university afloat in 1838. Well, at the low end estimate, there's about 12,000 individuals who are descendants of those 272 persons. And so if we allocated that $400,000 on an annual basis to all of the descendants in equal amounts, it would come to $33 a year. And I will add on top of that, that if you were going to try to match the $10 trillion sum that is required for the purposes of meeting the full reparations debt, you would have to have, 25 million people provide $400,000 donations, right? So this is untenable. The federal government has to meet this bill. And the last comment I want to make is that it's interesting that Sir Hillary was injected into the conversation,
because I think there is a very important initiative that he is leading for CARICOM, and that's an initiative to try to gain reparations for the Caribbean countries. But it's important that the agents that they are seeking reparations from are the countries and the institutions in those countries that colonized them and that engaged in enslavement towards them. So the CARICOM initiative is not seeking reparations from the United States government, nor is it seeking reparations on behalf of Black American descendants of U.S. slavery. So similarly, we hope they're successful, and we hope that they will support our efforts to gain reparations in the United States.
Thank you for your call, Buffalo. Let's go to back to Virginia again. Virginia.
Good evening, fam. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, all right. Hello, Elliot and Richard. Hello, Dr. Darity and Sister Kirsten. Look, I want to switch this thing a little bit. We've kind of had a long history, this little group I just mentioned and a few of the callers that were invited in too. This has been about a four-year run, and what I want to say, ask is, now that the different factions of, quote, Black people in America have really woken up and brought reparations to the national stage, I kind of been thinking about this in private, but I figure I'd ask two minds a little sharper than mine. What do we do now to all get focused on controlling the narrative about what reparations would look like and how we're going to get this done? This has been going on since 1860. You touched on a lot of things from grassroots to whatever. I personally think that the grassroots part of this from about 3 years ago is now bearing fruit. So what do we do to continue to control the narrative? Much love to you, fam.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. You want to start? You want me to start on it?
So maybe you should start. Well, it's interesting. We always are excited when folks are talking about coalition building. We are very aware that we're going to need a groundswell of Americans to support this movement for it to come to fruition. And so that means that we're going to need new and different congressional leadership in place. And it means as well that we're going to have to make certain that the folks who do represent us are aware of the reparations plan and are on board with it.
Yeah.
This is not a time to stand back and, as we used to say, hope is not a method. You need to be, outspoken, and you need to, make certain that the people who represent you are accountable to you, which is not something that we necessarily have been accustomed to doing.
Yeah. I think, a critical dimension of this is what happens with the congressional legislation for the formation of a study commission for reparations, H.R. 40. As a prelude to the Japanese-American reparations, there was a congressionally mandated commission called the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. And it accomplished two objectives. The first was it established that American officialdom knew that Japanese Americans were not a security threat to the nation, but still incarcerated the Japanese American community. And then the second thing it accomplished was it laid out a plan for legislative action to provide reparations to the Japanese Americans who were unjustly incarcerated during World War II. And I think we probably need a similar type of commission as a prelude for a reparations plan in the United States. The difficulty is that the existing legislation, H.R. 40, is not satisfactory. It has a number of weaknesses, some that I tried to detail in my written testimony for the congressional hearing that was held in June, on June 19th, a year ago. And I, I'm
I'm thinking that it becomes very important for us to have an active conversation and an active opportunity to revise and rewrite H.R. 40. And so I think that that's a portion of the narrative that needs to be taken out of the hands of individuals who are committed to the view that there should be no changes in H.R. 40. It needs to be revised. And I think that that's a critical step. The other critical step, I think, is that there needs to be the emergence of a consortium that will support reparations at the national level. And I'm thinking, and Kirsten shares this perspective, I'm pretty sure, that individuals who feel that they have an obligation to address the nation's heritage, if there are organizations that feel that way as well, then they should join in a coalition that petitions Congress for reparations for Native Black Americans. That's an important step, and to the extent that our community can foster that, that would be wonderful. I think that our local mayor, Steve Shule, in his State of the City address, has actually said that Durham, North Carolina, should be a city that takes a lead in exactly that type of a consortium. He is endorsing reparations for Black Americans at the national level, and he is also endorsing the equivalent of the formation of a study commission under H.R. 40, subject to revision of the legislation.
I would say, too, that Mayor Steve Shule is inviting, you know, other municipalities, but also cultural institutions, colleges and universities, and communities of faith to put their substantial influence and muscle, you know, behind this, you know, this coalition and to push for a reparations program for Black Americans. We had the opportunity last week to participate on a fascinating conversation on the line with Andam Gebre Georges, and so he was asking us about. So he is from the continent. He's from the country of Eritrea, and so he was asking us about, you know, what a coalition might look like, you know, with you know, a coalition for African Americans. You know, African American descendants of enslaved people in the U.S. pushing for reparations with the support of the continent. And we were momentarily just kind of stunned, you know, like, oh, wow, you know, what an amazing thought. And but eventually, you know, Sandy remembered, you know, there was this very amazing period in the 1950s, 60s, 70s when Black Americans and others were pushing really hard to support Black African countries in their determination to liberate themselves from the imperialist countries that had colonized them for, in some cases, centuries. I mean, I can remember myself as an undergraduate being involved with the African Liberation Support Committee and, you know, learning about, you know, who the movement leaders were in each of these countries. I mean, there are parallels. There are lots of parallels, lots of lessons to be learned, lots of opportunities for study, but also, you know, understanding what worked, what didn't work, and the pitfalls, especially. So, you know, I think there's a tremendous amount of possibility here. You know, if we can, you know, make a conscious decision to support each other in our determination to make our respective claims to, you know, these individual countries. And it's, and for some folks, it's multiple countries, right? Yeah, right. But, you know, certainly the work that we have done could be made available, you know, as a model. I mean, we're happy to work with others. This is the cause, this is the case that we are advocating. But there's absolutely nothing to stop other groups from pressing their case, and we think they should.
Ms. Mullen, a question I go to the next caller. Why were you stunned that the gentleman from the continent said that that it's possible that it we should work together?
Why were it was just stunned? In that moment?
Yeah, no. We've never heard anybody actually propose that the countries that comprise the African continent could get together and do anything to support Black Americans, you know, and so that was what surprised us. And then we came up with a suggestion.
Right. So the question, though, from our host came after I was talking about, you know, how the fact that Black Americans, unlike the Jews, we didn't have a country, you know, we didn't have an Israel advocating for us.
Yeah.
And he said, well, what would happen, you know, if you had the entire continent, you know, advocating for Black American reparations? And we just thought, wow, yeah, that's fabulous.
Well, I mean, but these things are going on. I know you.
We were momentarily just kind of stunned. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
But I know that you realize these things are going on. I know that you realize that. The thing that I said, I know that you realize that these things are going on. I think that what a percentage of our people don't realize, and I don't want to put the majority or a number on it.
Okay.
The percentage of our people don't realize that we're fighting the same enemy. I'm talking about whether we're on the continent, here in the U.S., in the islands, or even in South America. The same enemy is whether it was the Europeans here, which come off the European continent, whether it was Dutch, Portuguese, Danish, French, Spanish, we're all fighting the same enemy. And those people
no disagreement.
Oh, okay.
Terms of the specific support for Black American reparations.
Oh, yeah, I understand what you're saying there.
We're not aware of any unified effort on the part of the countries on the African continent to do that. And so when we were asked about this, we suggested that one of the things African countries could do is refuse admission or entry into their countries by American-based corporations until the United States government provides reparations for all Black Americans.
You know, I think this, you know, is interesting. I'm glad that our discussion is going in that direction, although I realize, and I want to take it back to what Sister Mullen had mentioned earlier, because I call it negotiation that we have to do internally, and mm-hmm. I think for the consortium that you were talking about, in order to just move for us to be unified in our difference, whether people take ownership of a policy that's put on the floor, or people are putting recommendations, or people are advocating using new platforms, until we can create a mechanism. And I appreciate the suggestion about that consortium, because we need a vehicle where we're sitting down and recognizing our differences, but realizing we're working towards the same objective. But I don't believe we have that now. And I don't think it's just going to come out of any individual leader, but it has to be an agreement. And if, as we do that, then it makes sense to be able to expand that negotiation to Africans on the continent, who are also looking, I mean, even with the Francophone countries are dealing with France around their concern. So, but I think until we can be able to resolve our internal organizing mechanism, especially as you laid out the history and relationship to whether it be Cali House or others who have pushed for reparations in this country, whether it be because of the civil rights. Not the civil rights, but the, you know, the whole thing around the Civil War and the backlash, that we'll be naive to think that there's not going to be any backlash. So therefore, we need to be in unison, not uniformity, but in unison of how we're going to address this, even to move this demand through, unless I'm misreading something. And it's that part that I'm really concerned about, us being able to create.
I think that makes tremendous sense. That makes tremendous sense.
Let's go to 267. 267.
Oh, this is Amira Lawson. Hello? Can you hear me?
It's 267?
Yeah. Yes.
This is Amira Lawson calling from
and, hold on a second. Hold on 1 second. 267, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Let's go to...
Hello?
I can hear you now. I can hear you now.
We can hear you.
We can hear you.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Atlanta.
All right.
This is Amira Lawson. And it's so wonderful to hear you, Dr. Darity and Ms. Mullen. Thank you so much for your contribution to our ancestry, to our people, to our future generations. Your book is marvelous. It's wonderful. And I can't wait to just get through and finish it. But, you know, I'm a little troubled with the conversation and some of the things that were said, because if we're talking about unity, and let me just say, I am a proud American descendant of slavery. And if we're talking about unity, I don't know how you can allow the caller from Buffalo to make very unfounded allegations about the very people who were supposed to benefit from the reparations movement. That's number one. And then number two, when we talk about Africa and unity, let's not forget that us ending up in America was a two-way trade. So are we saying that we're going to ask Africans who sold us over here to also be a part of this African conglomerate that's going to help us get reparations? Do they owe us reparations? And I will end right there.
You mentioned in your first comment, you said you didn't know how it can be allowed that a person from Buffalo said what? Can you make it a little clearer what you're expressing your concern about?
Sure. The gentleman who called from Buffalo basically said that me identifying with my ancestors and their experience is some type of vitriol. He's made allegations about funding. I don't receive funding from anyone but who I work for in my 9-to-5.
Well, he didn't say anything about you. He didn't say anything about...
No, he was talking about the group that I identify with. So when you make statements about groups, then you... Sir, I'm not trying to argue with you.
I'm not trying to argue with you either. But you're calling this... You're calling my program. You can't overtalk me, sister.
If we're going to be unified, then you...
Sister, you can't overtalk me. Listen, the man expressed his feelings in relation to the subject. He said about online conversations from groups in reference to the vitriol. Now, if you're honest, you hear that, whether you want to acknowledge it or not. He didn't say you. He don't know you. But he said the online conversations from some groups, he can hear the vitriol. Now, if you're honest, you can admit that he's right. Now, I'll let you finish your comment. You heard me, so I'll let you finish your comment.
If you were honest, you will see the vitriol that's directed towards us. But it's funny. No.
Listen, I'm black. The vitriol I see is from Europeans initiated towards us. If we back by one another, that's the ignorance that we have.
If the only vitriol you see is from Europeans,
you're not
going
to argue with me.
You're lying. Okay. You're the one that's
thank
lying.
Hey, sister, thank you for your call, and call again. Let's go to 313. 313, your question or comment for our guest.
Could we interject a couple of comments?
Oh, yes, certainly. Hold on, 313.
Just a moment, please.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to say a couple of things. The first is that any social movement has a wide variety of perspectives.
I think
there has been an attack, an unjustified attack on ADOS that hinges on people identifying what they view as allegedly xenophobic comments. But it is a grassroots movement. To the best of my knowledge, there's no external support that the ADOS effort has received. And so on that score, I think that the caller is absolutely correct. There's this rhetorical device that's frequently used to describe ADOS as being xenophobic And I don't know, there's some other negative that's always launched against the movement. But I think that the real problem is that there is still resistance to the idea that folks who are descendants of persons enslaved in the United States have a distinctive ethnic identity and have a distinctive cause, a debt that needs to be met, which is uniquely theirs. And I think that that's really important to bring into consideration. So, of course, there are some people who are saying things online that are vitriolic, but there are people in all camps who are saying things that are vitriolic. To the best of my knowledge, it wasn't the Eidos community that initiated the idea that the folks who were participating in online discussions about these identity issues were Russian bots. Okay, that didn't come from the Eidos community, and that was the first vitriolic attack that was ever made since this movement came into being. So I think that the caller has a very important point to be made here.
And I believe that it's important for us to recognize that there are forces, you know, because as I have followed and I've even joined the local Eidos, you know, chapter, as also have been initial member of the in Cobra, you know, local in Cobra back in the 90s, and have been interested in reparations as a Garvey member of the UNIA. So I recognize that in us organizing, there's a lot of challenges. That's why it's so important for us to, you know, have some vehicle where we can, you know, agree on what the strategic objective is, but at the same time recognize what our differences, or even what, as they say on the street, what our lane is. But you know what raises the question for me is how important we need to understand, and again, that this is a political demand that we have to push forward compared to a moral appeal that we're asking to be done. And because it's a political demand, and as you say, we're not a part of any, we're not coming, this isn't done by a nation state to a nation state or anything. We have to organize and operate as if we were, but that is something that we have to build. And I consider that as reparations also. I just think that is important because these, especially when we're talking about communication systems, that may be creating or inflaming different dialogue or creating individual hostilities because we don't have no mechanism to filter it out. So now people are arguing or seem like they're arguing. And there's truths in all of this, but seem like because we don't have no mechanism, it becomes really difficult. But when we realize that this is a political objective, and you mentioned earlier how that has to happen, even at the grassroots, because if you don't elect the right person, they're not going to advocate for reparations. If you don't have the right cultural groups at the table, they're not going to be able to deal with reparations appropriately. If you don't recognize, as you lay down in the book, the wealth disparity and how we have to appeal for to close that wealth gap, which is not just something you do in a moment, that has to happen over time and it has to be protected, we'll be spinning our wheels, or another generation will be spinning our wheels. So I think it's important for us not to get down in the weeds of these things when we have all these other things we have to put in place that reflects our internal healing, our internal reparations. I just wanted to throw that out there so we don't get locked into the back and forth of defending and it is a global problem, a challenge, as I see.
So can I speak that just a moment? I wanted to push back a little bit on what you were saying. I mean, I think that a moral appeal is important. Okay. You know, I think we need both sides, right? We need to have that steady, measured, informed political push, and we need the moral appeal. You know, I think part of the difficulty, and again, this goes to, you know, how informed are we? Black Americans and just Americans in general about the state of Black America. you know, I was really intrigued when the Occupy movement asserted itself. Mm-hmm. A lot of white people, I think many black people knew that they were not part of the 1%, but I think a lot of white people thought they were and learned in that moment that they were not even close. And I think that was a huge moment of awakening for a lot of people. Now, that said, you could not have told me, because that was, what, 2010, 11? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You could not have told me that the conversation that we were having then, we'd still be having today.
Right.
You know, we have a short memory in this country, but that conversation has endured. Because people are seeing every day what that means in reality, okay? And so the other point I wanted to mention is, you know, there have been a number of studies, and we quote several of them in our book, From Here to Equality, that indicate that Black Americans and white Americans, but especially Black Americans, have a much our sense of how well Black people are doing economically is much higher. It's inflated, you know, it doesn't reflect reality. And, you know, I always want to say, you know, who are these well-to-do Black people, you know, that they are imagining are blanketing the country? You know, do they get out and drive around and see, you know, Black communities that are, you know, in need of public services? But there's a, you know, it's like all of us want to believe that Black Americans, or too many of us want to believe that you know, the LeBron Jameses, the Oprah Winfreys of this world represent all of us, and they don't.
Yeah.
They absolutely do not.
Right.
And, you know, and when you have a moment as we do today with the pandemic, I didn't know if we were going to talk about that at all, but, you know, these things become abundantly clear that we are not, we don't have an equal playing field, and that Black people are absolutely at a disadvantage.
Well, I was going to add that when we do the so-called right thing, it doesn't have the same payoff. And I think this speaks to the Buffalo caller's comment about the desirability of scholarships being provided to Black Americans. Well, I'm all in favor of that. I'm an educator myself. I'd be hypocritical to say that I don't believe in the importance of education. But I think we also have to be realistic about what can be accomplished by education. And one of the limitations of educational attainment is it has very little to do with providing us with the capacity to eliminate the racial wealth gap. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, Black heads of households who have a college degree have 2/3 of the net worth of white heads of households who never finished high school.
Nope.
So the provision of scholarships to get college education is a wonderful thing. And that's because in part of the intrinsic value of getting more education. But don't suggest to me that that's a solution to the gulf in Black-white wealth.
Dr. Darney, Ms. Mullen, it was an interesting conversation. It's been 2 hours. Boy, the time really flies. I'm telling you.
I have enjoyed it. Thank you.
The book again.
Thank you for having us.
From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century.
Hope we can come back again.
Certainly. The door is always open.
We're very grateful for this opportunity to share these ideas. Thank you so much.
Wait a minute. Before you go, I want everybody to, now you can, because there's a link on the Time for Awakening website where you can get, you can link to the book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. And I know it's available on Amazon. Where else can the people get it? Is it a private concern where they can go straight to you? Is it a website? Give out any information. Where the folks can get the book?
Well, our publisher, University of North Carolina Press, and then booksellers everywhere, you know, including Amazon.
Okay. All right. And we'll be looking forward to further conversations, because this is not dying. The need for our people to be repaired by the people that did this to our ancestors is always going to be here. And I would like more of the church family to get involved, more social organizations to really get involved and really start doing the work. Be involved. Sister Mullen Ms. Mullen and Dr. Darity have been doing the work. So they want their work to be acknowledged and heard by other people. So, you know, we all have to be involved in the conversation. Time for an Awakening brings people on that are working in the community. So you've heard all voices from all sides of the spectrum that has been on here. Richard, you can attest to it.
Yes, sir.
We want our people to be involved in this. Dr. King said, nobody is going to do this for us. We have to do this. So we have to hear everybody's contribution, everybody's work. Dr. Darity and Ms. Mullen have put together a nice piece here that everybody should have. It should be a tool in your box. Get all the tools needed. Don't go out and prepare it. Again, I want to thank both of you for being with us, and we'll talk soon.
Soon, soon.
Yes. Soon. Either you all meet again soon in hell.
Okay. All right.
All right. Take care. Be safe.
Richard, before we wind up, let me take a little brief break, and I'll be right.
Hello.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kamban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard the special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me
had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
Not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you've called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP of the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we're black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Let me just say this
before our time winds up. And that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lauren Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. About ready to wind the program down. Richard?
Yes, yes.
Final thoughts?
I'm glad that we had this discussion. And, you know, the thing that I wanted to agree with Sister Mullen, you know, I accept that the moral appeal has to also be added. But one thing that I, you know, will emphasize when we start to expand and say, getting, say, Africans from the continent to engage. I think that's important, you know, that we create that bridge, right? But at the same time, we cannot create any bridge with anybody if we can't create bridges with ourselves. And the fight, this here fight for reparations is something, you know, as we it was outlined in our discussion, call it backlash. What white folks will do to protect themselves, what they will reinforce in their history books and impose on other people, what they will do in relationship to the political negotiation and deals they make in order to support each other, and what they will give away in land or wealth to beef up each other, that is not something that's happened in the past. And that's not something that's going to not happen in the future. So if we're going to be any different in positioning, we're going to have to do different in the now. And, you know, and I just think that I don't think that we understand that reality more, you know, more than that's our reality. And all the, anything
well, when
else
you say,
is a
when
distraction.
You say, okay. When you say do something differently, what do you mean as far as what?
And when she raised that the point that not having no protection.
Okay.
See, it's, you know, it's because we didn't think to protect ourselves when the 40 acres and a mule was offered. We didn't think that we needed to protect, because some families did get it. And some families in that, what is that, brief years after Reconstruction, towns and cities were created.
Mm-hmm.
Educational institutions were developed. That public education was developed. You know, but we thought that the others were going to protect us.
Because just to kind of expand on what you're saying, we didn't really realize even then, and we can learn lessons from our ancestors, that some of our people didn't really realize who the real enemy was.
Right.
And then history shows us what happened to, quote unquote, Americans. See, that doesn't happen to Americans. Right. That happens to, like Malcolm says, victims of this system, victims of America. Just like Ahmaud Arbery and Sister Breonna Taylor, victims. Now, we can stop being victims, and it's time that we do that. The only way we're going to do that is if we unify.
Mm-hmm. Not uniformity, unify.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, we're not clones, so I agree with you. We can't be, it's not a uniformity type of thing. We're not clones. We all have different thoughts. But we do have to unify for purposes. These other people do it. Why should we be any different? Do you understand what I'm saying, Richard?
Oh, definitely.
That's how this system of white supremacy has still been strong all this time and works. Because all these other, you might think, and especially if you don't educate yourself, that Britain, France, Spain, the United States, all these people are different entities. It might seem that way. They're unified when it comes to certain things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So that's all I'm saying. We need to be unified when it comes to a lot of matters that we're dealing with. And this is one issue that we need to be unified on.
Unified. And we have to create structures that don't exist and have to identify people who are, you know, that are in our best, not even just identify, create. People that are in our best interest. Other than that, we'll be waiting on something.
Yeah, that's why, you know, some of these things, it's going to take political moves to do it. And when I say political moves, I'm in your camp again. As a tool for organization, it's going mm-hmm. to take political moves to do it. And I do agree with Dr. Darity when he said we're going to have to change the leadership, the elected leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why we've been bringing these folks on, explaining to us what we're up against. Because if we make any moves globally or here, it's going to take political moves to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, next time that we have this, it's because one thing that and the people who don't have material wealth, we have to reclassify things. And it's still, I'm still stuck on this, Elliot, in the sense of our social organization is our wealth. Our ability to be organized is wealth. And out of that, we create more wealth. But when you're not organized, and using the example of this reparation effort, if you're not organized and we're saying we're going to close the wealth gap, you can only do that by being organized. And in this environment, using this structure, if we're going to put it that the government is, we're looking for repair from the government, then you have to use the political machinery to do that. And the only way you can use the political machinery is when you're organized as social political bodies, presenting your case, demanding your case, and being able to get the return. Now, it ain't a straight line, but it's definitely not going to occur if you're not socially organized, if you don't create wealth by your relationships with one another. I think that we just need to, you know, really look at, because when we define wealth, it is dealing with material things, but it isn't dealing with our social relationship. And I believe that as a mechanism of wealth, but that's something that we need to clarify, because you can't be disorganized and even run a business. I mean, even as a sole proprietor. If you disorganize, I don't think your business is going to run.
And listen, they'll use that same strategy that they've been using for hundreds of years in dealing with us, a divide and conquer.
Conquer.
And I'm exactly. glad that he mentioned tonight, when the brother mentioned from Buffalo, and he gave the analogy of what Georgetown did. I'm glad mm-hmm. Dr. Darity pointed out, from his understanding of economics, where this... that offer doesn't even make sense.
Right.
But it was accepted.
Mm-hmm.
He said it wasn't just the 273 members that was victimized by Georgetown at that time, but their descendants.
Right.
It comes to about $33 or something like that.
Exactly.
So again, that's a method of divide and conquer. If I'm one of them people at Georgetown, black families, that my son gets to go there, then I feel differently when it comes to reparations because you don't have it. That's the same divide and conquer. He was right when it says this has to come from the government. They did mm-hmm. it. They were a part of it, not these individual institutions.
Those institutions gave them what is called human capital to continue it because they educate them. They educated the next leaders, technicians, the next innovators. They put them through the process, and out of that, they go into the individual industries and individual areas of activities, and they produce and generate more wealth. So they work for the government. They work for the society as a whole. But who part? What part of the society? The white part of the society. And what class of that? And if you want to use the term or what group, that small group in the end, when they were saying that, the Occupy Wall Street, how white folks didn't realize that they ain't had no money either.
Yeah, well, listen, when y'all were talking and going back and forth, when you was exchanging ideals, and you mentioned about the historical significance of what we're mm-hmm. dealing with, mm-hmm. the struggle that we're dealing with, and he mentioned about the historical significance of how he's seen Callie House, mm-hmm. he's seen where Marcus Garvey was involved, and how mm-hmm. it morphed into Queen Mother Moore and others. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been talking about that, since we've been on, but I'm just saying, this has to be acknowledged. And he did that. But the thing that makes it more of an acknowledgement, Richard, is that the work that him and his wife continues to do.
Right.
That's what's important. The work. Then you become a player. And then your work, you can sit down with other men that have done work. And I'm quite sure intelligent brothers and sisters can sit down and map out what we need to do as a collective.
Mm-hmm.
See, I'll use an analogy. I can run my mouth about Kevin Durant, Michael Jordan, or whoever. But I ain't on the court. I ain't playing with them. I don't have the skill to play with them. Let the people that's doing the work this out. Join these organizations. But as far as being a cheerleader and talk about this person ain't doing nothing, he's doing something, you don't know what people are doing. And the thing is, you when you're saying that, you ain't doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's important that we keep the exchange of ideas going and keep people coming to the forefront, or at least on this program, that's doing work out here in the communities. That's important to me, and I know it's important to you.
Yes.
Before we leave tonight, I want to talk about the lineup on Time for an Awakening Media, and that's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. Always interesting conversation and dialogue on African Perspectives. That's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Right after him, it's Black Reality Think Tank with Black People's Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones. That's Monday and Wednesday from 1 to 3. later on Monday evening on Time for an Awakening Media. Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. That's 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening Media. Every first and third Monday of the month, Conversation Reparations and Cobra's program is on 9 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media. That's 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. And then he doubles back with the ladies featured on Black Reality Think Tank. And that's Saturday.
Dr. Rogers is a player now.
Well, I ain't saying that. He got women's voices out there talking on his program. They're facilitating it. You're going in another direction, Richard. Which is the women of Black Reality Think Tank have their program on Saturdays from 4 to 6 on Time for an Awakening Media. And Time for an Awakening is back on Friday from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware of, I know, the thing that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Save the world. save the children. To save the children.